interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
We're back into hour two on this Wednesday. That means Sire Watch Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hill and Dale and Sid Fernando. Good morning.
How's it going?
Yeah, there we go.
Can you hear me?
I didn't hear you. So I'll say good morning again.
Yeah, good morning, Steve. How's it going?
Not bad. Sorry to be a little late, but the Arlington story cast a long shadow.
No problem. I slept in, so.
Nice. Well, I've got topics for you. However, in terms of pedigrees, we'll get to that. And the Stallion barns are officially open throughout breeding jurisdictions around the country. But certainly the story, Sid, that is top of mind, the filing of a lawsuit to fight the 140 head count of stallion restriction. We talked extensively about it when the concept was floated, and your thoughts and what are the what kind of reaction you've heard here the last 48 hours?
I wasn't really surprised that this lawsuit was going to arrive. Certainly, Spendthrift and Coolmore were bound to challenge it. They've been joined in the suit by Three Chimneys as well. So, I don't think really there's a lot of chatter. People talk about this stuff, people have opinions of what's going on, limiting 140 mere books. I've seen people discuss stuff on Twitter and stuff. Unfortunately, what happens with this is that, Twitter's like a big classroom that in the same classroom, you have first graders all the way to 12th graders, if you're looking at the high school picture, right? And so the same topic is discussed by first graders and 12th graders. And, you can just understand, if you visualize it that way, say this is a 12th grade topic, and it should be in the 12th grade, but instead, you got second graders, third graders, first graders. And so the entire conversation becomes just so ludicrous after a while. Now, don't get me wrong, I love Twitter. I had a great decade on it. But as with any subject, Steve, there's some issues that are just above the pay grade of people. And normally, if somebody's talking to me about brain surgery, I'm not going to go in there and give them my 2 cents. I'm just going to listen to the 12th graders about it. I'm not going to listen to the first graders. But if you don't have expertise in the subject matter, you're best off trying to research it or listen to people that might have a better say in this. This is a case that has legal issues as well as other economic and business issues that are all intertwined in this thing. And essentially, as everybody knows, the Jockey Club set a cap of 140 mares for future stallions. They used the date of 2020, which is any colt born in 2020 that eventually goes to stud will be limited to 140 mares. Everything else beforehand they don't have to adhere to the same rules. So the Jockey Club, you know, wanted to be fair about this, so they said, okay, all stallions standing right now are foals of 2019, you know, that are just two-year-olds this year. They're exempt, and let's just start this, you know, from scratch with this date. And that's what they did. But it's such a complex topic because what this means, you know, is that, and don't get me wrong, I love the days when you had smaller books, and you know, I advocate smaller books as well. I think they're better for producing racehorses. But there are a lot of moving parts to this. But you know, taking my own view of books out of it, from a legal challenge, and I think this is a big issue because it's a law case, it's a suit. The plaintiffs in this case are alleging, you know, a restriction of trade. They're alleging a variety of things, but essentially they're alleging that this is economic protectionism meant to stop them from making money, meant to stop them from breeding as many mares as they want to their stallions, so that those excess mares would go to other stallions. And you know, I'm not, obviously, when there are major issues, whether it's in banking, whether it's in the environment, pollution, banking, you know, mortgage stuff that led to the collapse, obviously, in a lot of cases, there's need for regulation, right? I'm not anti-regulation whatsoever. However, in every case, there should be some reasoning and evidence and discussion before something is passed. And in this case, what the plaintiffs are alleging is that the Jockey Club maintains, and Jim Gagliano made a statement, which I saw on the TDN yesterday, maintained that this was done by the Jockey Club, the registrar of the breed, to protect the health of the thoroughbred, because they feel that there's too much inbreeding taking place. And that's why they're doing this. Now, if you talk to anybody in Kentucky, nobody mentions that. They mention, you know, these guys are breeding too much and we want some of those mares to our stallions. But the Jockey Club's official position has to be that they're, and is what they've stated, that they're concerned about the welfare of the thoroughbred. And of course, it's a great lightning rod to get people that don't know a lot on their side, by saying, oh yeah, they're breeding too many horses, you know, the breed is getting inbred, and it's going to seed and so forth. The problem that the Jockey Club did when they made this thing is they said that, but they never offered any type of scientific proof. Can I add a couple of things in here?
Go ahead. Absolutely. I was counting on you. I left this alone. I left this alone for you. Yeah.
Now, the Jockey Club feels that they, you know, they're on real solid legal ground because the standard bred industry also, in 2009, I believe, limited stallions to 140 mares. However, here are the differences with this case and the standard bred industry, and I think the Jockey Club feels that they're in strong ground. I think their legal team thinks there's no antitrust issues. However, here's the big difference. The standard bred industry actually commissioned a study. That study was presented to its members. Now, the USTA that runs the standard bred organization, to breed standard breds, everybody has to be a member of the USTA. In this case, the Jockey Club is a private club. You can't become a member. In fact, you have to be invited to become a member. The USTA, you have to be a member. So there's industry participation right from the get-go in that versus this. Number two, there was a scientific study that was conducted and sent out. No scientific study was conducted and sent out here. Number three, the major proponents for limiting books in the standard bred industry to 140 were actually the guys at the top that were breeding excess mares, and they thought it was not good. They went against their own economic interests. Here, that's not the case. The stewards that are named, or the institutions that are named in this suit, are not the people that are breeding excess mares. In fact, they're the beneficiaries if this thing takes place. Number four, the standard bred industry is AI is permitted, and there's a much lower population of horses. So can you imagine with AI, you could have rampant large books, right? Here, there's a larger population of horses, and AI is not permitted. So there are significant differences, and I don't think the Jockey Club should, be confident that this case is going to be dismissed out of hand. I think that I've read this lawsuit. My wife is working on a case right now, so unfortunately I wasn't able to get her to read it, but she did promise me she's going to read it this weekend. She's an attorney. However, I've read it, and I think that there are things in this case that are going to be problematic for the Jockey Club. And unfortunately, what the biggest issue, Steve, that we're seeing here is yet another fractured part of this industry. Instead of working together, you've got groups at each other's throats. And that's where we are in terms of that. Now, there's so much more you can, you're not going to change behavior because the game has changed. Back in the good old days when you had smaller books, that's because owner-breeders dominated the game. These days, it's a commercial marketplace, and commercial breeders want to breed the two types of horses, first or second-year horses or elite-proven horses. Really, this cap is trying to address all these other stallions that aren't getting mares, such as third, fourth, and fifth-year horses. And those horses are not going to get mares, even with a cap, because commercial breeders, as long as they're the ones that dominate this game, are not going to breed to them. Why? Because they're not going to breed to a stallion and take a yearling to market and have the risk that that stallion has not done anything at the track while you're presenting a yearling to sell. If that stallion has runners and they haven't done anything, that commercial breeder's yearling is going to get punished in the sales ring. That's why they like to go to first-year horses, because when that yearling sells, it's a clean slate. There's nothing negative about that stallion yet. When you go to sell a second crop yearling, you have some risk. You know, like the people at Bret to Say Run Happy last year, when they sold their second crop yearlings, the first crop was at the races. In Run Happy's case, they didn't start winning till this year. So yearling buyers last year got punished in the ring because buyers stayed away from the Run Happy. Run Happy this year is having a hell of a run, okay? But those are the reasons why you're not going to get mares to third, fourth, and fifth-year horses by putting a cap in place. It's just not going to happen as long as commercial breeders are the guys breeding the lion's share of horses, and that's exactly what's taking place right now. I turn it over to you.
Well, and you said the right thing about the working parts, because there's the biodiversity conversation, there's the economic restrictive element, and then there's actually the reality that, when it comes to the biodiversity. It's kind of funny, because if in fact the concept were to hold, there's only going to be the choices. If you can't get to Into Mischief, well, you're going to go to a son of Into Mischief. I mean, it's not as if this would force people to go, to go find, some long forgotten line that's being ignored to rebirth it.
And even within that concept, Steve, in your particular example, actually is a good example of that this year, in that, Into Mischief, if you don't get to him, Spencer also has Authentic, who's a first year horse, and that. But there's also the matter of stud fee ranges, right? I mean, somebody that doesn't get into a $150,000 horse isn't going to suddenly want to just, breed that mare to a $20,000 stallion.
That's true.
So there's that part of it as well. There's also this, I think the biggest issue is that the Jockey Club maintains that they're doing this for altruistic reasons, to quote unquote save the breed, the welfare of the breed, but they have not issued a single scientific paper. Ordinarily, in a discussion period, when a topic like this is brought up, you have a comment period and people go back and forth. The Jockey Club has maintained this, but has not ever presented anything. So why would you institute Rule 14C, which is what this rule is, without giving evidence to your constituents? That's one of the biggest and puzzling parts of this, and a big differentiating part to the USTA, which did present a scientific paper and then acted upon it. Above all this, and I have a strong interest in legal issues, so for me, I'm very, very skeptical of the Jockey Club's move, only because they didn't present the paper. Imagine if they presented a paper and said, "Oh, look, these scientists are saying that the breed is getting inbred, and this is going to be bad for the breed or whatever." And here's that's what we're going to do. If that were the case, you know, I think they have a leg to stand on. Usually what determines what's good or bad are racetrack results. You know, I was looking at some of the classic winners from last year, and, you know, they've got six crosses the Northern Dancer, and they're winning. And that's supposed to be bad? Well, usually what's bad is when they don't win. You know, when Calumet had a stranglehold on Bull Lee Sireline and that blood, and they were, you know, Bulldog Teddy Line, and they were winning everything, and then suddenly they went kaput. You know, what happens is usually it takes care of itself. They don't they're not working anymore. Empires crumble, and then new ones form. And that's usually how it takes place. If a sire line isn't working, people go elsewhere, and then things rejuvenate. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
And that's usually the way things are. You know, we're not talking about environmental pollution here or global warming at a scale that's, you know, impacting all of us, humanity. We're talking about a small game called horse racing and breeding. And I don't think there's one group that should say, hey, you shouldn't be breeding a horse this way or that way. You know, again, I like small books. I don't have a problem with that. But overreach, you know, is the element that I'm concerned about here. And I'm just reminded about something from years ago when Ray Roncari, Scriptar Farms, you have a mare from that family. One of your mares, you know, has three dams bred by that Raymond Roncari.
Sure. Well, Voltaire.
Anyway, yeah, Voltairine, right, yeah. And, you know, he was from Connecticut, obviously, Scriptar, you know, Winlock, and
Windsor, which stands for Windsor Locks.
Windsor Locks, yeah, exactly.
But my dad, Ron Carey, you know, my dad's in construction, and worked a lot with Ron Carey over the years.
Oh yeah, no kidding.
Oh sure.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it was you know, he got to he knew another guy from Connecticut. And that's the owner, Mr. Prospector, Ace Coast Stable. And so when Mr. Prospector hit big in Florida, he bought a share in that horse. And when the horse got moved to Claiborne, you know, he was breeding, he would send mares over there. And there was one year where, and I could just imagine the look on Seth Hancock's face when he sent the daughter of Mr. Prospector to Claiborne to be bred to Mr. Prospector. And Seth Hancock realized that this is the shareholder in the stallion. He was appalled by what the guy was doing, but he honored the business contract, and he honored Ron Carey's desire to try whatever he wanted to. He didn't like it, but he bred him daughter of Mr. Prospector to Mr. Prospector so that the foal was 1/2 to Mr. Prospector, inbred 1/2, which is about as close as you can get. And you know, we're getting to the point now where, you know, the Jockey Club is essentially saying, oh, no, you can't do this kind of stuff on a macro level, of course, they're saying it. But, you know, again, I think, do I think that they're too much? Yeah, I do think so. I think that, you know, you dilute quality by doing it. But again, you know, I support the rights of people to do it because until, you know, there hasn't been anything illegal in doing that. And as far as I'm concerned, generally, the idea of inbreeding, you know, the thoroughbred is inbred. It's extremely inbred. And like you said, you know, until somebody shows us some data that we can actually, and the Jockey Club should have presented that data to people, you know, I think it seems pretty one-sided that they were able to, you know, just say we're doing this. And there's a lot of skepticism and cynicism about the motives. And that's reflected in this lawsuit, which actually, you know, I was stunned at how explicit they laid out the, you know, the case. I think in one section it said, right here, I have it in front of me. It said here, it actually named names. It says here, many of the stewards that adopted the stallion calf and that currently serve on the Jockey Club Board of Stewards themselves have conflicting economic interests, owning and or representing various competing racing and breeding private entities such as Stone Street Farm, Barbara Banky, Cheyenne Stables, Everett Dobson, St. Elias Stables, Vinnie Viola, Jump Sucker Stable, that's Stephen Dunker, Tick Stables, that's Ian Height, he's an executive with Equibase. Ocala Studs, that's, you know, the Farrell, Mike Farrell, and Darby Dan Farm, John Phillips, and Lane's End Farm, of course, the Farishes, whose economic interests will be served by the Stallion Cup. Now, that's a big shot.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's all at war.
Well, this, you know, it seems I'm gonna come up with another second Godfather reference of the morning. You know, as Clemenza says, it's okay. We got to have these every couple of years.
That's great.
A lot of bad blood.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's a perfect analogy. Because, you know, underneath this veneer of Kentucky hospitality and everybody loves each other, this is a vicious game that's being played on these farms. And, you know, the guy's smiling. Hey, how are you doing? How's the family? And, you know, they go back and they, you know, they put the silencers on their weapons.
Well, much like the first hour's story with Arlington, we'll see if there's, you know, an Act 3, what's going on there, or an epilogue. And the same with this. It'll proceed through the circuit court. A couple of minutes, Sid. There are two quick things, and because I've got Brian Bouye at 11 as we release.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Coming up, yeah, with the Hall of Fame. I don't know if you heard, you know, you mentioned Run Happy, you mentioned in passing earlier, had a visit with Mac last week, and, you know, really it was about the, you know, about the situation in Texas and his incredible largesse. But I, you know, I wasn't going to miss an opportunity to talk racing issues and Run Happy with him too. And,
yeah,
you know, you mentioned that, you know, these 3-year-olds are running, and we brought this up in the last few weeks, that it was very clear that, the question I've got is, will the way the horses are showing up now as they turn from 2 to 3, will it help him in this next round of selling, or will there be people that see this and, you know, that had been a little, you know, ambivalent about breeding to him this year? Will they reconsider that? How does these, you know, these 3-year-old runners, how does it benefit him in the marketplace?
Oh, first off, I just want to say to my my friend Bernie Sands at Claiborne that I'm very thrilled for him, and as I am for Walker Hancock, who, you know, I have a lot of respect for. That's Seth Hancock's son. It's not easy taking over a major farm like this, you know, and Seth did it at a young age, and now his son has done it at a young age. Storied farm, and it's great to see this type of success, because Claiborne is one of my favorite farms, just for its historical importance, as well as, you know, it stands some excellent stallions, Warfront being the top one. How does it help? Well, what happens is the stallion, when he goes to stud that first year, usually gets his best book of mares. We're seeing these horses right now at three running. That's from the first crop. In the second crop, usually they get their, you know, not as good a book, but a pretty decent book as well. Then you have third and fourth crops. You know, by the time a stallion has 3-year-olds, he's in his fifth season at stud. So, as I referenced earlier, you know, those 3, 4, 5 years are tough years for a stallion. What they've done is they've dropped this horse's stud fee from $25,000 to $10,000. And with the number of winners that we see in the spring, as the breeding season heats up, it's really opportune for him. I think he's going to get a lot of action at $10,000. I think people are going to go back to the stallion. I don't think he's going to have, you know, he's not going to get the same type of mares that he got that first book. But that may be a good thing, because people might realize at this point, hey, you know what, he needs a different type of mare maybe, or whatever, or we need to handle him differently. So he's going to have, you know, he's going to get mares this year at 10,000. There's no question about it. The good thing about a farm like Claiborne, another reason I like the farm, is they do give the stallion a shot. You know, they're not, you know, they're not gone before the 2-year-olds have already raced. Or as what happened with California Chrome, or at the end of their 2-year-old seasons, as what happened with Daredevil. And Daredevil, I bring up, is a good example, because Daredevil was, his first 2-year-olds ran, and they, you know, they had, he had nothing going for him. He'd only served like 19 or 20 mares that year, and things were looking bleak for them for their fifth year. So they sold the horse at the age of, you know, with his first 2-year-old had run. He's in Turkey, and the 3-year-olds come out, and you get Swiss Skydiver and She Dares the Devil when the Preakness and the Oaks, Kentucky Oaks, respectively. Swiss Skydiver becomes the champion, and the horse comes back now to stand here as the property of the Turkish Jockey Club. There's a case, you know, where people had cut these horses loose early because there was no patronage, right? If you look at what Claiborne did with Orb, they kept going until finally they were forced to sell for this season, because there was just no patronage. And so with Orb, they finally did sell, but they gave him plenty of opportunity, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts. Bernie, in fact, told me that at one point he said, you know, he feels bad because Orb did disappoint a lot of people. You know, they owned it. They gave it a ride. And usually what you have to do is give a horse, you know, you got to go through that first and second book. So you should have some 4-year-olds and 3-year-olds run before you can really make a pronouncement, because those two first books contain the best mares possible. And if he's any kind of horse, he's going to do that. He's going to get something done with that first book. If not at 2, maybe at 3 or 4. If they don't do that at 3 or 4, how are you going to make the stallion? Because you've given your best books of mares to that stallion, and he's got to do something, you know? And so that's basically how that works.
Now, we've hit on this in different, you know, with different individuals over the years, and of course, this is probably a good spot to include the famous John Nayrud axiom is or was that continues to be that you can't accurately judge a stallion's success until you've had seven crops. That's what that was the Nehrud.
Yeah, and I'll put one footnote to the Nehrud comment. And he was talking during the period when, you know, you had 40 mare books. So you're talking 180 horse, say 40 times 7, that's 280 foals, right? These days, first and the second book, third, say, you're getting to that level right away. So that's the only difference.
Sid, I did want to ask you about, we're going to run out of time here, but because I've got to get Brian in, but in the back of your mind, I do, and we'll have plenty of chance down the road, the winner of the Hyacinth on Sunday, kind of interesting, a very, very female U.S. Pedigree. So we'll talk about that one when we get a chance.
All right, you got it, yeah. That's, of course, the Kentucky Derby prep in Japan. We'll talk next week.
Exactly, and I just got a wonderful question from Paul Stevenson, which I'm copying you in on. He's asking about genetically unique bloodlines and our breeders looking for that. So we'll fold that into our mailbag, Sid's mailbag. We'll call it. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hill & Dale and Work Thoroughbred Consultants, 510-490-1111. 510-490-1111. Plenty of time for broodmare compatibility analysis and decision-making. I talked to Larray this morning at Rock Ridge, who's going to join us next week. He says they've had one baby a day at Rock Ridge down in Hudson for 24 straight days. So everybody's getting, you know, a lot of people are starting to see their...
Wow.
Their babies, and you got a chance to, you know, see what you came up with from your last cover. So, you know, if you want to move away or you want to go back, but either way, you need Sid and Roger and Val. Work Thoroughbred Consultants. Let's take a break. Top of the hour's here, and of course, you know, for Hill & Dale, get a hold of Jared and John at Hill & Dale to you know. Space is running out. Get on those lists. We will come back. Brian Bouye is going to join us from the Hall of Fame, and we'll find out who the finalists are that will be voted upon for induction into the National Museum of Racing Hall of Fame. Back after this with Brian.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Sirius XM Sports presents